retaliation for the coup plan by the assassination of an American official, but on American soil, something the officials had considered unlikely. 5 years later, former Senate investigator Bud Fensterwald found several newsmen at the Chicago Daily News who knew about the four-man threat in Chicago, even though they did not write about it at the time. One of the newsmen said, "At the time of JFK's scheduled visit to Chicago on November 2, 1963, there were four men in town who planned an assassination attempt from one of the overpasses from O'Hare into town. They were seized, but apparently not arrested." The assistant city editor also recalled a disassembled rifle in the story. However, as Fensterwald's memo of the interview with the newsman puts it, "For some reason, the story about the assassination attempt did not get in the paper." A fifth man, ex-Marine Thomas Valley, whose job overlooked JFK's motorcade route, was arrested at 9 a.m., 2 hours before JFK was scheduled to arrive in the city. In his car, he had an M1 rifle and 3,000 rounds of ammunition. Knowing of at least two potential assassins still at large, JFK and Bobby apparently decided to cancel JFK's entire trip. They also decided to keep any mention of the assassination threat out of the press, and the press complied, even though several newsmen had heard about the four-man threat. If the threat was made public, and the four men turned out to be Cuban agents retaliating for the JFK-Almeida coup plan, then the plan and Almeida could be exposed. That could have resulted in a dangerous confrontation with the Soviets just a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Remarkably, there is no evidence that those making the Cuba contingency plans, like my State Department source John Crimmins, were told about the Chicago threat. Information about the Chicago and Tampa threat appears to have been limited to higher officials, especially those in the Secret Service and FBI, two agencies not directly involved in the Cuban contingency planning. As JFK's press secretary Pierre Salinger explained to me, just after he assured the press that JFK would not cancel the motorcade because of a crisis in Vietnam, he had to quickly issue two different phony excuses for the cancellation. The initial reason given for JFK's sudden cancellation was a cold, although that was quickly changed to the need for JFK to stay in Washington to deal with the aftermath of the assassination of Vietnamese President Diem. While Diem's death probably was a factor in JFK's decision, news services had already run a story from Salinger saying that special equipment had been installed in Chicago so that JFK could monitor the tragic events in Vietnam during his visit. The Kennedys had done this kind of news management on a smaller scale in the past, involving incidents as diverse as leaks about the Bay of Pigs and reports of JFK's sexual indiscretions. The CIA had suppressed news stories related to Cuban operations, such as a Florida incident in September 1963, when the agency made sure two local newspapers suppressed and turned over photos of several covert Cuban exile operatives after their boat had problems. Suppressing a news story on the scale of the Chicago threat against JFK took a new level of coordination among Robert Kennedy and several agencies, but the Cuban aspects of the threat seemed to justify it. Not until years later would the public learn that Valley had recent ties to a Cuban exile group training to assassinate Fidel Castro. Valley also had ties to the John Birch Society, widely known at the time for its extreme stance against civil rights, Martin Luther King Jr., and JFK, especially his seemingly soft stance on Cuba. As mentioned earlier, the CIA and INS had also received reports of a possible Cuban agent named Miguel Casas Saez in Chicago, but they were unable to track him down. In addition, two of the men sought in the Chicago incident had Hispanic names, and a later CIA memo says the plot allegedly involved Cuban dissidents, which meant exiles. The suspects also had a possible family connection to Tampa Fall guy Gilberto Lopez. Those Cuban connections are why Bobby and JFK kept any mention of the four-man Chicago plot and the real reason for JFK's sudden cancellation out of the press. Former Chicago Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden confirmed the four-man Chicago threat and told congressional investigators and Fensterwald that it was handled differently from any other threat against the president. Bolden said that when Chicago Secret Service Chief Maurice Martineau first learned of the threat shortly before JFK's scheduled visit, he told Bolden and the other agents there were to be no written reports. Any information was to be given to him orally. The chief would report only by phone to the head of the Secret Service, James Rowley, personally. Bolden testified that instead of the usual file number, any written information was put into a COS file. COS stood for Central Office and Secret. COS files were kept separate from all others, and the Secret Service could say they had nothing in their files on a subject when, in fact, a COS file existed. After the last-minute cancellation of JFK's trip to Chicago due to the threat, said Bolden, the memos were then taken to O'Hare Airport and given to a crew member of a commercial flight to Washington. He believes a Secret Service employee met the flight and delivered the material to Secret Service headquarters. But that wasn't the end of the secrecy about the four-man threat. Bolden said that shortly after the JFK assassination, the Chicago Secret Service chief called all agents into his office and showed them a memo from Washington to the effect that the Secret Service was to discuss no aspect of the assassination and investigation with anyone from any other federal agency now or at any time in the future. Every agent was made to initial this memo. Bolden thought this memo was directed at the FBI, who wanted to get the role of presidential protection away from the Secret Service. Decades later, former Chicago FBI agent Thomas B. Call recalled, "Some people were picked up, and I'm telling you it wasn't ours. This was strictly a Secret Service affair. You'll get no more out of me." Author Vince Palomara wrote that Abraham Bolden was adamant that Chicago Secret Service Chief Martineau knew about the four-man plot to kill JFK. In 1993, Martineau himself confirmed the existence of the plot to Palomara and said he assumed everyone knew about it. Martineau also added that he believed JFK was killed as a result of a conspiracy and that there was more than one assassin. The investigation of the Chicago assassination threat went along two paths that began more than 48 hours before JFK was set to arrive. One investigative path, sparked in part by a tip the FBI passed along to the Chicago Secret Service, was about a four-man assassin team in the city. Several Chicago Secret Service agents kept watch on two of the four-man assassin team. But, as Agent Bolden later told congressional investigators, through a series of blunders, the surveillance of the two assassins was blown. According to investigative journalist Edwin Black, the agents had been able to pick up the trail of only two of the four men who had been watching the rooming house where they were staying. When the two men left, one Secret Service agent followed them in an unmarked car. However, the car with the two men suddenly reversed direction on a narrow street and began doubling back, so the two men wound up going past the Secret Service agent's car. They overheard the agent's radio and realized they were under surveillance. With its surreptitious surveillance blown, the Secret Service felt it had no choice but to go ahead and detain the men. So the two subjects were apprehended and brought to the Chicago Secret Service office, Bolden told investigators. Black writes that the two men were taken into custody, but not actually arrested or booked, in the very early Friday hours and brought to the Secret Service headquarters. There are no records that any weapons were found in their possession or back at the rooming house. The lack of any weapons and the premature ending of the surveillance before the two men had committed any crime presented a problem for the Chicago agents. Threatening the president was not a federal crime at the time. The only information about the two men being a threat came from the FBI, which was loath to share informants with other federal agencies. Without knowing the source or circumstances of the original information about the four-man threat, the Chicago Secret Service faced two problems: how to find out where the other two men were, and how long they could justify detaining the two men they did have in custody. Once the two men were detained by the Secret Service, no doubt various checks on them, or at least on the aliases they were using, were run in an attempt to find an outstanding warrant or other reason to hold them. Richard Kane, chief investigator for the Chicago Cook County Sheriff's Department, was in a perfect position to monitor or even influence law enforcement's reaction to the Chicago plot. A made member of the Mafia, Kane had also worked on the CIA Mafia plots for Rosselli, Traficante, and Marcello. Kane would have known about the two suspects detained and lookouts for the two still at large, showing that the secrecy of the assassination plot had been blown. The plan was no doubt called off by Kane's mob superiors. Kane's position also would have allowed him to follow a second important part of the Chicago plot. The second path of the Chicago investigation focused on ex-Marine Thomas Valley. The report of the House Select Committee on Assassinations confirms that, on October 30, 1963, the Secret Service learned that an individual named Thomas Arthur Valley, a Chicago resident who was outspokenly opposed to President Kennedy's foreign policy, was in possession of several weapons. That same day, according to an FBI report, two Secret Service agents conducted a pretext interview of Valley and noted that he had two M1 rifles in his possession, along with a .22 caliber revolver and an estimated 1,000 rounds of ammunition. Unlike the other ex-Marine fall guy, Oswald, Valley was serious about guns. The Secret Service agents returned to the office and reported their concerns to Martineau. On or about Thursday, October 31, 1963, one day after the Chicago agent's pretext interview of Valley, Valley's landlady called the Secret Service office and said that Valley was not going to work on Saturday, according to the testimony of Agent Edward Tucker to congressional investigators. The agent testified that because Saturday was the day of JFK's visit to Chicago, this information resulted in the Secret Service having the Chicago Police Department surveil Valley. A later FBI report says that as a result of the Secret Service request to the Chicago Police, a 24-hour surveillance was placed on Valley and his activities by the Chicago Police Department. On the morning of November 2, before JFK's motorcade was canceled, Thomas Valley was heading into the city. According to congressional investigators, he had put one of his M1 rifles and his pistol in the trunk of his car, where he also had 3,000 rounds of ammunition. Valley wore a shirt with an open collar and a jacket, similar to what at least one member of the four-man assassin team was wearing. According to Edwin Black, police records show that Valley was arrested around 9 a.m., about 2 hours before JFK's scheduled touchdown at O'Hare. The two police officers following Valley pulled him over for left turn without a proper signal and found a hunting knife in his front seat. That was all the pretext the Chicago police needed to search his car, where they found the M1 rifle and 3,000 rounds of ammunition. An FBI file says a subsequent search of Valley's home by Chicago police discovered an M1 rifle, a carbine rifle, and about 2,500 rounds of ammunition. A different FBI file says that Chicago police charged him with an assault with a deadly weapon charge. By Saturday night, November 2, 1963, all the suspects who were in custody, Valley and the two who were part of the four-man team, had been released. As Abraham Bolden told congressional investigators, the two suspects in Chicago were turned over to the Chicago police, who took them away in a patrol wagon. According to Edwin Black, who had several Chicago police sources, when no evidence had been found to justify holding the men, they were released. As for the heavily armed Valley, the HSCA report says that he was released from Chicago police custody on the evening of November 2. Valley was apparently never even brought to the Secret Service office for an interview, then or in the coming weeks. The Secret Service didn't even talk to ex-Marine Valley in the days and weeks after the Dallas assassination was blamed on fellow ex-Marine Oswald, even though Secret Service records, some of which are still classified, show that the agency maintained an interest in Valley for at least the next 7 years. Clearly, there was more to Valley and the Chicago attempt than the records released so far reveal. After the cancellation of the Chicago portion of the plot, Marcello's two shooters from Europe headed south. As Marcello explained to his cellmate, Jack Van Lanningham, in a conversation secretly recorded on FBI undercover audio tape, the two hitmen left Michigan and came to his huge 6,400-acre Churchill Farms estate. The estate had its own airfield, so they could have been flown directly there, perhaps by pilot David Ferry. It's long been documented that Marcello and Ferry spent the weekend of November 9 and 10 working on strategy at the secluded farmhouse in the middle of the vast Churchill Farms property. Marcello's federal trial continued in New Orleans, so the two later claimed to government investigators that they were working on trial strategy. However, Marcello had top attorneys to handle that, and Marcello's main strategy involved bribing a key juror to ensure his acquittal, or at the very least a hung jury, and Ferry was not involved with that. Their meetings at Churchill Farms were also unusual because Ferry usually met with Marcello in the Godfather's office at the Town and Country Motel, as he had done several times in October. Marcello admitted to Van Lanningham that two rifles were obtained from a New Orleans gunsmith so that two European hitmen could conduct target practice, safe from the view of law enforcement. Because of the ongoing trial, the government had to be careful not to intrude on Marcello's privacy or talks with his attorneys or their representatives. Ferry officially worked for one of Marcello's attorneys. That created the perfect situation for Marcello and Ferry to help prepare the two hitmen for the upcoming hit against JFK. Ironically, at the same secluded house where 1 year earlier Marcello had revealed his intention to kill JFK to FBI informant Ed Becker. Investigators for the New Orleans District Attorney later found notations in the margins of one of Ferry's books, a reference manual on high-powered rifles, showing that Ferry had measured exactly how many feet an empty cartridge flew when ejected from that rifle and at what angle. Also, shortly before his weekend planning session with Marcello, David Ferry admitted that he'd purchased a .38 caliber pistol and that he'd deposited the $7,000 mentioned earlier into his bank account. On November 7 and 8, 1963, Jack Ruby talked to two of Hoffa's associates in lengthy telephone conversations. Earlier, on November 1, Ruby had called Chicago, and on November 9, Ruby's recent visitor from Chicago, Lawrence Myers, was in New Orleans. Ferry had called Myers just over a month earlier. It seems unlikely that Myers was anything more than a low-level message courier who knew nothing about the overall operation. Jack Ruby's volume of long-distance phone calls continued to explode in November. His usual number of calls per month was fewer than 10, but that number had risen to almost 30 in September, and in November there would be at least 110 phone calls. Ruby's cover story, at the time and later accepted by the Warren Commission, was that the calls were simply about a union problem involving his performers. However, many of his calls were to an incredible number of Mafia and Hoffa associates. They served as intermediaries and cutouts, as no doubt coded phrases were passed from Ruby to eventually reach others involved in the plot, with those in the middle knowing nothing of the assassination plans. Ruby could be helpful to Marcello not just if the president was killed in Dallas, but also if the hit was in Tampa. Ruby had been stationed in Tampa during World War II, and in recent years had reportedly made trips there to recruit strippers for his club. On November 9, 1963, undercover Miami police tapes recorded white supremacist Joseph Miltier talking about JFK's murder less than 2 weeks before the assassination in Dallas. Miltier told Miami police informant William Somerset about a plan to assassinate the president with a high-powered rifle from a tall building. On the police tape, Miltier accurately states that authorities will pick up somebody within hours afterwards just to throw the public off. Miltier said the assassination had been arranged in such a way as to drop the responsibility right into the laps of the communists or Castro. Somerset also told authorities that Miltier had indicated this conspiracy originated in New Orleans and probably some in Miami. Miltier said there was a lot of money involved in the plot, not only from far-right extremists, but from men who could afford to contribute, though the only one he mentioned by name was a Louisiana political boss who was tied to both Carlos Marcello and Guy Bannister. The Miami police told the Secret Service and FBI about the tapes and plot. The FBI assigned Atlanta agent Don Adams to the case on November 13, and he went to the southern Georgia town of Quitman, where Miltier lived, to quietly investigate him. However, Adams told me that his FBI superiors never told him about the Miami police tapes of Miltier. He later learned they withheld other relevant information from him as well. Miltier was not arrested before JFK's Tampa motorcade, before Dallas, or even after JFK's murder. While parts of the Miltier story and the audio tapes have been known to investigators for decades, it was only in 2006 that Michael L. Kurtz published accounts of reliable witnesses who could tie Miltier directly to Guy Bannister and other associates of Carlos Marcello. He wrote that on one occasion, a noted architect saw Bannister and Miltier conversing with some of Marcello's people in the French Quarter. Aside from sharing racist views and hatred of the Kennedys, Bannister, Miltier, and Marcello also shared a connection to the illegal arms trade, since in 1963 the major buyers of illegal weapons from organized crime included Cuban exile groups and white supremacists. Miltier traveled extensively and was in touch with the most violent racist groups active in 1963, as well as those trafficking in arms. Kurtz also noted that Miltier had close connections to Santos Traficante, since Miltier was also involved in illegal arms and narcotics trafficking. Miltier would continue to make accurate remarks to Somerset about JFK's murder in the coming days, showing he was aware of and possibly involved in the plot. Miltier had inherited $200,000 from his father, over $1 million in today's dollars, and his determination to kill JFK appears to have been motivated by his racist ideology more than money. John and Robert Kennedy were told about Miltier's threat before JFK made his trip to Florida. However, by mid-November 1963, JFK and RFK were dealing with pressing Cuban issues on several important fronts, in addition to an array of foreign crises and domestic problems. A November 8, 1963 Los Angeles Times article, headlined "Kennedy Ducking Cuba Problem, GOP Says," and picked up by other newspapers, slammed JFK for doing nothing about Cuba. The article reported, "Republican Party claims that the Kennedy administration had swept Cuban affairs under the rug since the missile crisis of October 1962. A review of articles in the New York Times from May to November 1963 shows a constant stream of charges that JFK was soft on Cuba from Republican presidential hopefuls Richard Nixon, Nelson Rockefeller, and Barry Goldwater. Senator Barry Goldwater, the eventual Republican nominee, was especially vocal, accusing JFK, his former colleague on the Senate Crime Committee, of doing everything in his power to keep the flag of Cuban exiles from ever flying over Cuba again. President Kennedy was doing a great deal regarding Cuba, but none of it was in the public eye. Even while JFK was making his final attempts to reach a peaceful solution with Castro, he continued his efforts to overthrow the Cuban leader. As the December 1, 1963 date for the coup approached, Commander Almeida indicated to Harry Williams that he wanted JFK's personal assurance that the president would fully support the coup once it began. The plan was that on November 18, 1963, following JFK's long motorcade in Tampa, the president would go to Miami to deliver a speech, several lines of which would specifically reassure Commander Almeida that he had JFK's personal backing. A CIA report from 1963, uncovered years later by congressional investigators, confirms that in Kennedy's speech of November 18, 1963, in Miami, the CIA intended President Kennedy's speech to serve as a signal to dissident elements in Cuba that the U.S. would support a coup. The CIA report states the wording was intended for dissident elements in the Cuban armed forces who must have solemn assurances from high-level U.S. spokesmen, especially the president, that the United States will exert its decisive influence during and immediately after the coup. Years later, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Cy Hirsch wrote that CIA officer Seymour Bolton, an aide to Cuban operations chief Desmond Fitzgerald, told a congressional investigator that he had personally delivered the key paragraph written for JFK's speech. Declassified files withheld from Congress and not seen by Hirsch confirm that Bolton's supervisor, Fitzgerald, was a key participant of AmWorld and the JFK-Almeida coup plan. The last memo, declassified from the Cuban contingency planning, shows that on November 12, 1963, the subcommittee was still working on the preparation of contingency plans to counter the following possible actions by Castro, including the attempted assassination of American officials. However, apparently John and Robert Kennedy, still digesting the political and security fallout from the canceled Chicago motorcade, decided against sharing information about the Chicago threat with the entire subcommittee. Telling all the subcommittee members would have meant their supervisors, aides, and secretaries could also find out, which could compromise the security of the impending coup plan. So most of those working on the Cuba contingency planning and other key personnel hadn't been told crucial information about the assassination threat in Chicago. Declassified files show that Robert Kennedy was set to meet with coup plan exile leaders Harry Williams and Manuel Artime in Washington on November 17, 1963, the day before JFK's important speech for Almeida. But neither Williams nor Artime was told about the Chicago threat. The stakes were incredibly high for JFK and RFK, since just 5 days after the Chicago attempt, American newspapers reported that Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev had publicly warned the U.S. that attack on Cuba will lead to war. That made it all the more crucial that no hint of the coup plan could emerge from any investigation of the Chicago threat or any threats that might emerge during JFK's upcoming trips to Tampa and Miami on November 18, 1963. On November 17 in Florida, President Kennedy and his aides were putting the finishing touches on the image that JFK wanted to project to assure Commander Almeida of his support. That weekend, JFK had been at the Kennedy Palm Beach estate with Richard Goodwin and other aides creating the final draft of his important Miami speech. JFK already had the passage the CIA had carefully crafted for Commander Almeida. The aides working on the speech didn't know about Almeida or that the CIA had written a small portion of JFK's remarks, as Goodwin confirmed to me. JFK's recent activities had been orchestrated to send a show of strength to Almeida and his allies in Cuba. That day, Florida newspapers featured major front-page coverage of JFK viewing the launch of a Polaris missile from a submarine. In Tampa, JFK was scheduled to have a private, though widely publicized, meeting with the head of Strike Force Command, now Central Command, and other military brass, including some brought in from Washington. Coupled with the special lines in JFK's speech, all this was designed to reassure Almeida that JFK would back him and the coup all the way, even with U.S. military force. The plot to kill JFK was also proceeding on November 17, 1963. In Tampa, Gilberto Lopez was waiting on a very important phone call. According to the Senate Church Committee, Lopez was at a get-together at the home of a member of the Tampa chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, where he was for some time waiting for a telephone call from Cuba, which was very important. It was understood that it all depended on his getting the go-ahead order for him to leave the United States. The released records give so many different reasons why Lopez claimed he wanted to return to Cuba that it's hard to pin down the real reason. Congressional investigators wrote that Lopez told his wife he had received financial assistance for his trip to Cuba from an organization in Tampa, and he would not have been able to pay for the trip without help. Lopez's trip would be unusual because he didn't own a car or drive. Yet, after JFK's Tampa motorcade, Lopez would embark on a long journey by car to Texas. Lopez would then be driven by a still unidentified person to Mexico City, where he would catch a flight to Havana. Declassified files say that Lopez had a brother studying in the Soviet Union at the time, which would have made Lopez useful to U.S. intelligence, even though an FBI report says that Lopez spoke very little English. In addition to not being able to drive, Lopez also had no passport and little money, so someone who could help him get to Cuba could have used that as a way to manipulate him. That could have been a U.S. intelligence agency, the mafia, or, as in the case of Oswald, both. A 2003 newspaper report pointed out how Lopez might have come to the attention of the mafia, concluding that Gilberto Policarpo Lopez's movements and activities suggest that he was a possible participant in Traficante's activities, though on a very low level. As for the call Lopez was waiting on from Cuba, that could have been from any number of mafia or U.S. intelligence assets who traveled to Cuba, including some who worked for David Morales. In her first interview with a journalist, Lopez's wife, they never divorced even after he returned to Cuba, told me Lopez was a painter by trade, and that when she left him in Tampa, he was working painting a big building across from where they lived in Ybor City. The small Ybor City enclave in Tampa was frequented by Santo Traficante since it was home to his favorite restaurant. A high Florida law enforcement official I spoke with identified the full name of a man linked to Gilberto Lopez and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee who was watched closely in conjunction with JFK's visit. The man's last name was Rodriguez, one of the names that had surfaced in the Chicago threat investigation. However, neither that official nor Tampa Police Chief Mullins, who had recently taken over from Chief Brown, was ever told about the Chicago threat. According to one account, Lopez had another suspicious associate. The Tampa Tribune later reported that on November 17, 1963, when Lopez attended a meeting in the home of a member of the Tampa chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, also thought to have been at that meeting, was Lee Harvey Oswald. The article goes on to say that recently declassified FBI files quote, operatives, as saying Oswald met with a member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in Tampa on that date, though that information was never confirmed. My high Florida law enforcement source stated that an informant said that he'd met Oswald at an FPCC meeting in Tampa with several other people present, just before JFK's motorcade. The informant remembered Oswald's appearance, but not his name, so if it was Oswald, he may have been using an alias. This informant was different from the one cited by the Tampa Tribune, Joe Burton, who was known to our source as someone who helped the FBI. According to John H. Davis, over the weekend of November 16, 17, 1963, the real Oswald disappeared entirely from view, and his whereabouts on those 2 days still remain unknown. For the Tampa assassination attempt, the point is not whether the real Oswald was in Tampa or not on November 17, 1963. What is important is that someone wanted authorities to think he was or might have been. Before JFK's Tampa motorcade, officials there would issue a lookout describing a potential assassin that actually matched Oswald much more closely than the first description issued after JFK's murder in Dallas. 3 weeks after Chicago, the Kennedys faced a shocking development at a critical time when officials discovered another plot to assassinate JFK, this time during his long Tampa motorcade on November 18. Officials uncovered the plot less than 24 hours before JFK's arrival and advised him to cancel his visit, since at least two potential assassins were on the loose. Tampa Police Chief Mullins told me that he also advised the president and his staff to cancel JFK's visit. However, another sudden cancellation was not a viable option for President Kennedy. While he and RFK had been able to keep the real reason for the Chicago cancellation out of the press, another major motorcade canceled at the last minute would surely raise questions they couldn't answer. In addition, JFK was set to give his important speech that night in Miami, and the important lines of assurance for Commander Almeida. How could President Kennedy ask Almeida to risk his life to stage a coup if word leaked that JFK had been too afraid to travel in his own motorcade? Despite the warnings, JFK decided to go ahead with the motorcade. Jackie wasn't with him on this trip, so the risk would be his alone. The Tampa threat was verified not only by Chief Mullins and a former head of the Florida Intelligence Unit, who wishes to remain confidential because of his efforts against Santo Traficante and his crime family, but also from newspaper accounts, which appeared the day after JFK's murder, and several official files. The threat involved at least two men, one of whom threatened to use a gun and was described by the Secret Service as white, male, 20, slender build. That description could fit Oswald or Lopez, who were just a few years older. Although Hispanic, Lopez had a light complexion. According to congressional investigators, Secret Service memos say the threat on November 18, 1963, was posed by a mobile, unidentified rifleman shooting from a window in a tall building with a high-power rifle fitted with a scope. That was the same basic scenario as Chicago and Dallas. However, those congressional investigators weren't told the threat was active in Tampa. Chief Mullins confirmed that the police were told about the threat by the Secret Service prior to JFK's motorcade through Tampa, and they had their own source as well. The threat triggered even more security precautions. One motorcade participant recalls commenting at the time that at every overpass, there were police officers with rifles on alert. Secret Service agent Sam Kinney said he learned later that organized crime was behind the threat. The former head of the Florida Intelligence Unit, who worked closely with the Tampa police at the time, said that he was certain there was going to be a hit on JFK in Tampa. He later confirmed that Tampa mob boss Santo Traficante was involved. The official accompanied the presidential party and said that the strain of dealing with the threat was why Kennedy appeared handsome, tan, and smiling in front of the crowds, but appeared tired and ill backstage. Nevertheless, JFK went out of his way to present a fearless image in Tampa in spite of the threat. After finishing one of his speeches, JFK surged out into the crowd, which immediately engulfed him. The Secret Service men with him went crazy, according to a report in a local newspaper. The article also noted a motorcade participant's recollection of how concerned everyone was when JFK stood up in the car as he rode through the streets of Tampa after his talk. We'll never know whether he did so because of his ongoing back problems or, in case word of the threat leaked to the public, to show he wasn't afraid. Chief Mullins and other officials were especially concerned about Tampa's tallest building, the Floridian Hotel, which overlooked a hard left turn for JFK's motorcade. The red brick Floridian looks similar to the Texas School Book Depository, only much taller, and with more windows. Almost 100 had a clear view of JFK's motorcade. The hotel was full that day and impossible to secure. In 1963, one could easily register under a false name. At that time, many travelers paid with cash, and every guest room window in the Floridian could be opened. The hotel was just one short block away from the intersection where JFK's limo would have to come to almost a full stop to make its turn. For a sniper perched in one of the hotel windows, sitting back in the shadows, assassinating the president would have been all too easy. Chief Mullins and the Secret Service didn't know if the two suspects at large were Southern white supremacists, disgruntled anti-Castro exiles, pro-Castro exiles, or Cuban agents. The shadowy Cuban Miguel Casas Saez, who was reported near Chicago just before JFK's motorcade there, had also been reported in Florida. Even without knowing about Marcello's two hitmen from Europe, officials in Tampa had plenty of reasons to urge JFK to cancel his entire motorcade. but JFK disregarded their warnings and insisted on going ahead. The clear bubble top for JFK's limo wasn't used. It wasn't bulletproof anyway, and using it would send the wrong message to Commander Almeida. The Lincoln in which JFK rode in Tampa was the same one he would later use in Dallas. Just as in Chicago, a complete press blackout about the threat was informally ordered. A tight lid of secrecy was clamped down on all information about the threat. Two small articles appeared right after JFK's death, but even then, the story was quickly suppressed, and they received no follow-up. Chief Mullins was quoted in those articles, at first openly talking about the threat, but by the following day saying nothing, and he didn't speak for publication about the threat again until I interviewed him in the mid-1990s. The attempt to kill JFK in Tampa was withheld from the Warren Commission and all later government investigating committees until I told the JFK Assassination Records Review Board about it, in writing, on November 24, 1994. According to the Review Board's final report, just 2 months later, January 1995, the Secret Service destroyed Presidential Protection Survey reports for some of President Kennedy's trips in the fall of 1963, including Tampa. The Secret Service informed the board a week after it destroyed the records, when the board was drafting its request for additional information. That destruction, apparently, broke the law, since the 1992 JFK Act that created the review board had required agencies to preserve all relevant records. However, when the Secret Service destroyed records for JFK's Tampa trip in 1995, Commander Almeida was still alive in Cuba, and his secret work for JFK not been publicly exposed, giving the Secret Service a possible national security reason for its actions. After JFK's death, the Tampa threat still could not be exposed to the general public, since there was still the chance that Oswald or other suspects might prove to have connections to Castro or the coup plan. The public's faith in the Secret Service, already at a low ebb after Dallas, would have been shaken to the core if weeks or months after JFK's death it was revealed that the agency had covered up an assassination attempt in Tampa that had so many parallels with Dallas. JFK gave several speeches in Tampa, including one at the International Inn, where, 4 days later, Santo Traficante would publicly toast JFK's death. After JFK concluded his Tampa trip, a member of the Tampa Police Motorcycle Detail told the St. Petersburg Times that Chief of Police J.P. Mullins introduced each of us to the president, who was no doubt grateful that he had survived the motorcade unharmed. The ex-chief of the Florida Intelligence Unit told me that Santo Traficante had called off the attempt to kill JFK shortly before the president's arrival. He explained that Traficante's man in the Tampa Police Department, Sergeant Jack De La Llana, was in the motorcade meetings and was feeding information to Traficante at the time. The official source, who also helped with JFK's security, said it was likely that De La Llana could have tipped off Traficante about the security plans and, once the plot became known, about the threat alerts. Chief Mullins said his department provided much information to the FBI at the time of the Tampa threat. However, those documents have never surfaced in declassified FBI files. In fact, the declassified Tampa Field Office FBI file from the time of JFK's trip at the National Archives makes hardly any mention of JFK's trip to Tampa, indicating that Bureau files related to the threat were considered highly sensitive and filed separately. The sheriff of a county adjacent to Tampa confirmed to the Tampa Tribune in the small article that slipped out the day after JFK's murder that officers had been warned about a young man who had threatened to kill the president during that trip. In the article, Chief Mullins mentioned another man at large, identified as a threat, and wondered if the two may have followed the presidential caravan to Dallas. Chief Mullins didn't know at the time that Gilberto Lopez had indeed headed to Texas, reportedly Dallas, or that two more men investigated for JFK's murder, involved with Traficante's drug network and described shortly, were also headed from Florida to Dallas in the coming days. On the evening of November 18, the president flew to Miami and gave his most important speech, with lines directed at Commander Almeida and his allies in Cuba. Those carefully crafted sentences were also designed so they would not upset JFK's back-channel negotiations with Fidel. In his speech, JFK proclaimed, "What now divides Cuba from my country is the fact that a small band of conspirators has stripped the Cuban people of their freedom and handed over the independence and sovereignty of the Cuban nation to forces beyond the hemisphere. They have made Cuba a victim of foreign imperialism. This, and this alone, divides us. As long as this is true, nothing is possible. Without it, everything is possible. Once this barrier is removed, we will be ready and anxious to work with the Cuban people." The following day, several newspapers trumpeted those lines almost too clearly. The Dallas Times-Herald said, "Kennedy virtually invites Cuban coup." The Miami Herald said, "Kennedy invites coup." And the New York Times proclaimed, "Kennedy says U.S. will aid Cuba once Cuban sovereignty is restored under a non-communist government." Commander Almeida was satisfied with JFK's remarks in Miami and communicated that to Harry Williams. Declassified files show that in the days following Almeida's response to JFK's speech, Robert Kennedy had his final meetings in Washington with Manuel Artime and Harry Williams before the coup. Robert Kennedy arranged for Harry Williams to have a crucial meeting with CIA officials on the morning of November 22, 1963, as later confirmed by the Washington Post. After JFK returned to Washington, he expressed his relief at surviving the trip to his close aide, David Powers. According to Kennedy biographer Ralph Martin, JFK told Powers, "Thank God nobody wanted to kill me today." JFK explained that an assassination would be tried by someone with a high-power rifle and a telescopic sight during a downtown parade, when there would be so much noise and confetti that no one would even be able to point and say it came from that window. After JFK's Tampa motorcade and Miami speech, John and Robert Kennedy could breathe a sigh of relief as they looked ahead to JFK's upcoming trip to Texas. They knew of no active threat in Texas, as there had been in Chicago and Tampa. Moreover, Dallas didn't have a large Cuban exile population to worry about, as did Tampa and Chicago. Chief Mullins wondered if two of the Tampa suspects may have followed the presidential caravan to Dallas, and there is a well-documented account of two men and a woman doing just that. The woman was Rose Cherami, one of the many aliases used by Melba Christine Mercades, a member of the lowest rung of the Mertz Marcello Traficante heroin network. Cherami was a sometime B-girl, prostitute, and heroin courier for Ruby. On November 21, 1963, Rose Cherami had been dumped on the side of the road by two men she was riding with from Florida. She was eventually taken into custody by Louisiana State Police Lieutenant Francis Frouge, who drove her to East Louisiana State Hospital to be treated for heroin withdrawal. Cherami told Frouge that she and her two male companions had been on their way to Dallas, where the men were going to kill Kennedy. Her remarks were also heard by physicians at the hospital, including Victor Weiss, head of the hospital's psychiatry department, who said that on Thursday, November 21, Cherami was absolutely sure Kennedy was going to be assassinated in Dallas on Friday and kept insisting on it over and over again to the doctors and nurses who were attending her. According to Dr. Weiss, Cherami said that word was out in the New Orleans underworld that the contract on Kennedy had been let, and Dr. Weiss assumed she was referring to Carlos Marcello's organization. Cherami would later be proven an accurate informant regarding Marcello's part in the French Connection ring, but at this time no one was taking her seriously. It's ironic that a woman who was one of the lowest members of Marcello's crime empire came so close to exposing part of the Godfather's plot, which could have saved JFK's life. The man at the highest levels of that heroin network Michel Victor Meretz had been traveling in America in 1963, sometimes under his own name, most recently in October, and sometimes under the name of Jean Souetre, an old associate from a mission that Meretz had undertaken for French intelligence several years earlier. Meretz, who won the French Legion of Honor for killing 20 Nazis for the French resistance in World War II, sometimes did work for French intelligence to avoid prosecution for his crimes. Jean Souetre, the alias Meretz used in Dallas on November 22, 1963, and in the days before, was the name of a fugitive French officer who, in 1962, had participated in the attempted assassination of French President Charles de Gaulle. This attempt was more serious than the one Meretz had foiled a year earlier, since Souetre's group was able to hit de Gaulle's car with numerous bullets. The French president survived, and the incident inspired Frederick Forsyth's novel, The Day of the Jackal. Souetre was one of several men imprisoned for the attempt, though he later escaped. Jean Souetre himself did not travel to America in the 1960s, and on November 22, 1963, the real Souetre was in Barcelona, Spain, and has witnesses to prove it. On the other hand, INS records provided to the French government show that Meretz traveled frequently to America in 1963 and before as part of his heroin smuggling activities. Souetre was a loaded name for Meretz to use as his own, since the real Souetre had met with and sought support from the CIA in May 1963 in Europe. Souetre had even been the subject of a memo by Richard Helms in the summer of 1963. Former Senate investigator Bud Fensterwald found that the FBI had traced the man they thought was Souetre to Dallas a day before the assassination and then lost him. The fact that Meretz was using the identity of a wanted French presidential assassin recently tied to the CIA was sure to generate fireworks when his alias surfaced as being in Dallas when JFK was shot. Chapter 14. JFK is assassinated in Dallas. In the days before the president's trip to Dallas, John and Robert Kennedy were dealing with matters related to their upcoming coup in Cuba. Richard Helms had shown RFK and JFK a Cuban rifle from a 3-ton Cuban arms cache left by terrorists on a Venezuelan beach, as well as blueprints for a coup by Castro against the president of Venezuela, according to historian Michael Beschloss. Helms was no fan of JFK and RFK's secret peace feelers with Castro, so this was probably his attempt to short-circuit any peace negotiations and to cover himself if his unauthorized CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel were uncovered. A later U.S. military investigation by Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Haig and Joseph Califano, both working for Army Secretary Cyrus Vance, concluded that many of the items found were, in fact, of U.S. origin. Even veteran CIA officer Joseph B. Smith would write in his memoirs that he was not too impressed with this evidence of the Venezuelan guerrillas' intended use of the arms. It sounded to me as though we might have manufactured it. Smith's memoirs, written decades before the JFK Almeida coup plan was first exposed, also contained an interesting remark he heard in 1964 from CIA official Desmond Fitzgerald. Without providing any details about how it would have been accomplished, Fitzgerald told him, "If Jack Kennedy had lived, I can assure you we would have gotten rid of Castro by last Christmas, 1963. Even within the CIA, little more than a handful of people knew about Commander Almeida, but Fitzgerald was one of them. Robert Kennedy celebrated his 38th birthday on November 20, 1963, and shortly after that had his last meeting with Harry Williams. RFK had arranged for Williams to meet on Friday, November 22, with a group of CIA officials for a final planning meeting for the Almeida coup. After a session that would stretch from morning to afternoon, Williams would leave for Miami that night. From there, he would be flown to the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo on November 23, and from there slip into Castro's Cuba to meet personally with Almeida and await the coup on December 1. The 10 days from November 22 to December 1 would essentially be the countdown for the JFK Almeida coup plan. Once Harry Williams was inside Cuba, around November 26, there might be no turning back for JFK and RFK, since secure communication with Williams at that point might be impossible. RFK appears to have been close to finally telling some cabinet officials, including Dean Rusk, about Commander Almeida, letting them know that the coup plans they'd been working on for months were about to be put into effect. Responding to a still-classified memo RFK had written on November 20 about Cuba, JFK's National Security Advisor, McGeorge Bundy, replied to RFK by saying, "The Cuban problem is ready for discussion now, so we will call a meeting as soon as we can find a day when the right people are in town." JFK was getting ready to leave for Texas the next day, while Rusk and several other cabinet members would be flying to the Far East on the same day. Earlier the following week, around November 25, would be the soonest all the administration's top officials could be gathered. That may well have been the meeting at which officials like Rusk and McNamara would finally be told about Almeida, since at that point the coup would have been less than a week away. JFK and RFK had been hoping for a breakthrough with their peace feelers, but progress was slow. A November 19, 1963 White House memo says that Special UN Envoy William Atwood was dealing with Fidel's doctor, who'd wanted Atwood to come to Cuba, but Atwood had replied this was impossible for the present. He wanted Castro's doctor to come to New York, but the doctor couldn't make the trip. Instead, he proposed having Atwood talk to Cuba's envoy at the UN. Even this was just to have preliminary talks for the discussion of an agenda for actual negotiations. The ball was left in Castro's court, but the slow pace must have frustrated JFK and RFK, especially with the December 1 coup date looming. The Kennedy brothers had no way of knowing that their other secret peace initiative was finally starting to produce results. In Cuba, French journalist Jean Daniel finally had the meeting with Castro he'd been waiting for since late October. According to Arthur Schlesinger, after spending 3 fruitless weeks in Havana, Daniel was surprised by a visit from Fidel Castro at 10 p.m., the night before the journalist was scheduled to leave Cuba. Daniel and Castro talked until 4 a.m., and Daniel conveyed Kennedy's wishes from late October about his desire for dialogue. The two men arranged to have lunch again, to continue their discussion, on November 22, 1963. Not only is the date ironic, but the location of their lunch was to be Castro's villa at the beach, at Varadero, the very place one later M-World document identifies as a good place to assassinate Castro, since it was near the home of CIA asset Rolando Kubela. However, with no U.S. embassy in Cuba or other secure way to communicate, JFK and RFK had no way of learning that Daniel had met with Fidel or that he was scheduled to meet with him again. Robert Kennedy was continuing his unrelenting attack on organized crime, not just in the courts but also in the press. During the week of November 18 through 22, the New York Times ran an impressive 5-part series about the ties between the Mafia, Hoffa's Teamsters, and Las Vegas. RFK had supported the Times investigation by providing crucial information and quotes. The articles revealed that RFK was getting ready to run the Mafia out of Las Vegas, the mob's relatively secure stronghold. A separate Times story that week would have also pleased RFK, as it spotlighted the Mafia ties of one of JFK's potential rivals, when it reported that Senator Goldwater admits association with Willie Bioff, labor racketeer slain in 1955, and Gus Greenbaum, gambler slain in 1958. The publicity-shy Johnny Roselli had ties to both murders. RFK's Times series capped an autumn full of anti-mafia publicity, which had begun with the nation being riveted by a new series of televised crime hearings that for the first time truly exposed the inner workings of the mafia. Mobster Joe Valachi, the star of those hearings, had cooperated with authorities only because he was facing a death sentence. RFK's goal was to galvanize the public against the mafia using the Valachi hearings held by the Kennedys' old friend Senator John McClellan. The focus of the hearings was organized crime and illicit traffic in narcotics, striking at the heart of Trafficante and Marcello's lucrative French connection. On November 20, RFK had been briefed on the progress of the Marcello trial in New Orleans, according to John H. Davis, who says RFK was told a favorable verdict was expected in a couple of days. For Friday, November 22,